Now, how can someone be both a servant and a master? Usually, we think of an individual as being one or the other, but not both. However, in John chapter 13, in the very text that was just read for us a moment ago, we find that Jesus shows himself to be both. The text divides itself into five parts that we want to look at this morning. First of all, there is the moment. Second, the motive. Third, the malevolent. Fourth, the master. And fifth, the message. Let's begin with the moment that we find in chapter 13, just the first part of verse 1. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, that's the first part. And it deals with the fact that this is the hour that is coming. Jesus' enemies had tried to kill him at least two times previously. Let's go back and read chapter 7, verse 30, just to refresh our memories on that. John 7:30, then they sought to take him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. And then we read it again in John chapter 8 and verse 20. These words Jesus spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, and no one laid hands on him, for his hour had not yet come. But now his hour is coming. And he begins to explain that in John chapter 12 and verse 27 that we looked at recently. In that text he says, "Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I came to this hour." And then he goes ahead and asks God to glorify him. So the hour was now upon him. It was his moment. The motive is also given in chapter 13, verse 1, in the second part of the verse that we did not read just a moment ago. Let's continue then where we left off. He knew that he should depart to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world. He loved them to the end. Jesus loved his disciples absolutely, completely, without reservation, despite their imperfections and disappointments. As Brother Guy N. Woods wrote in his commentary on John, "It is the kind of love that is not affected by the failure of its objects, nor is diminished by the unworthiness of those upon whom it is bestowed." So this is the kind of love that Jesus had for all up until the end, as long as he was living upon the earth. But now as we move to number two, verse number two, we find a malevolent one is mentioned. Amid the disciples, there was a malevolent individual. And after the supper had ended, the devil, having put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, this is certainly not the type of individual we would expect to see amongst the Lord's disciples. So Judas had already betrayed Christ before the moment we're reading about here in John 13. Let's back up to Matthew chapter 26 And notice verses 14 through 17. Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went into the chief priests and said, "What are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you?" And they counted out 30 pieces of silver. 30 pieces of silver. That doesn't seem like very much, does it? So from that time, he sought opportunity to betray him. Now on the first day of the feast of the unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover?" This shows that this had already happened by the time we get to John 13. They were still making preparations for the Passover feast when Judas went out and did the work of betrayal. So Matthew gives the details of that, and we read about the malevolent Judas. He had been with Jesus for about 3 years during the Lord's public ministry. He had been given power to cast out demons, had he not? He had been given authority to teach and preach the good news of the kingdom. Was his motive only money? He was treasurer, and John said that he had stolen from the money that was collected to help others. So he seems to be a rather unprincipled follower of Jesus. Did he think Jesus would use his miraculous powers to fight and escape his enemies if he betrayed him? Some have alleged that, but we don't know that that is the case. Whatever his thinking was, he was wrong. And Jesus had warned him concerning that. In Matthew chapter 26 and verse 24, Jesus says, "The Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would be good, have been good for that man if he had not been born." Now, I don't know what was going through Judas's mind. I don't know that anybody except the Lord would know that. But when you hear that pronouncement, how can you not rethink what you're doing? Why did he just not go back immediately and say, "Look, I don't know what I was thinking of. I was crazy. I had a moment of temporary insanity. I'm giving you the money back. The deal's off." He could have said that, especially in the light of the warning that Jesus had given him. But he followed through. And so Jesus ends up being betrayed. Now, Satan may have suggested this idea of betraying Jesus, but he ran with it. Satan is always suggesting evil things. We read of good things, we read of honorable things, we read of noble things, and possibly we are inspired of them, but we also come in contact with the opposite. Coming in contact with those things, having them enter our mind, is not necessarily evil, but when we start entertaining the evil, then it is. Judas, no doubt, had thought of betraying Christ, and he should have dismissed that and said, "No, I would never do that." But instead, he entertained the idea and then followed through with the idea. Unfortunately for him. So, let's go to point number 4. The master. We have a malevolent one, but we also have a master, and that is Jesus. Let's read verse 3 again. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, Doesn't this describe someone who is in control? Doesn't this describe someone who is, in fact, a master, the master of his fate? He knew who he was. He knew from where he came. He knew where he was going. He knew that Judas was going to betray him and that he would be enduring a great trial, that he would die physically, but that he would be raised again on the third day, and that he would eventually ascend to the Father. Jesus had full knowledge of the entire situation and was in control of it. Men did not do anything to Jesus that he did not allow them to do. He is the master. Now, he is going to give them a message, however, and that message is going to be communicated by example and by teaching. Let's notice verses 4 and 5 one more time. He rose from supper and laid aside his garments and took a towel and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. The master has a message, and the message is that the master is a servant. Jesus teaches this by demonstrating it in a way that it is doubtful they would ever forget. The one who girds his waist with a towel and begins to wash the feet of guests is a servant. The towel is a badge of slavery. It was common in this era, this historical era, for men to wear sandals. And doing so, the feet would be covered with dust or dirt. And when someone came into a house or someplace, a servant was usually there to wash the feet. Now, when they came into this room to observe the Passover, one or two of the disciples might have decided to perform this function, at least to Jesus, if not to each other. But now they are through with dinner and no one has volunteered to do this menial task that would ordinarily be assigned to a servant. So Jesus does it. Do you suppose that the disciples were mortified when they saw Jesus put the towel on him and begin to wash their feet? The Lord was humble enough to perform this act of hospitality that none of them had volunteered to do. Well, let's look at verses 6 through 11. Then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, "Lord, are you washing my feet?" Jesus answered and said to him, "What I am doing, you do not understand now, but you will know after this." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no part with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Jesus said to him, "He who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you. For he knew who would betray him. Therefore he said, 'You are not all clean.'" Now, what we have here is a couple of plays on words, which God uses throughout the Bible and which Jesus used in the New Testament. Peter speaks regarding the situation. Are you surprised that Peter would be the first one to speak? And Jesus told him and the disciples, you don't really know what I'm doing. You don't understand what I'm doing now, but you will. You will understand later. Well, Peter could have said, what do you mean I don't know what you're doing? There's a basin, there's a towel, here's my feet. You're washing my feet. Well, obviously, that was the case. But the significance of it had not yet dawned upon them. And so they needed a little bit of time to think about the significance of what Jesus was doing. Now, Peter protests with a very strong negative. Using a double negative, he says, you may not wash my feet forever. That's how it is in the Greek. Meaning, as long as the world stands. But Jesus says, if I do not wash you, you don't have any part with me. Jesus did not say he must wash Peter's feet. Did you notice how he answered? He said, if I don't wash you, you have no part with him. He could have specified feet, but he left it broader, and this is a play on words, referring both to his feet in the physical sense, but also cleansing him entirely in the spiritual sense. So, Peter quickly acquiesces, abandoning his never policy, and he now asks Jesus to wash all of them. Well, returning to the physical, Jesus points out that if a person has bathed and then walked through the street, only his feet are dirty and in need of washing. But then Jesus now uses another play on words. He closes with, you are clean. But in this case, it's the plural, referring to all the disciples. But he says, you are clean, as though talking to Peter alone, but he is including, by the use of you, all the disciples. And then he says, but not all of you. Specifically, he is referring to Judas when he says, you are not all clean, because he knew Judas was his betrayer. And he was not clean, and he had embraced evil thoughts. Well, that is the example that Jesus gave of the message. Now we want to look at the message explained. And we'll look at verses 12 through 17 in order to accomplish that. So when he had washed their feet and taken his garments and sat down again, he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you ought to wash each other's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, but he who is sent is greater than he, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. So the example now is explained in verses 12 through 17. So we want to notice that this is the kind of attitude that Jesus expects his followers to have, something along the lines of what Paul would later write in Romans chapter 12 and verse 3, when he wrote these words. For I say, through the grace given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly and as God has dealt to each one of us a measure of faith. Is that why the disciples, nobody had arisen to wash each other's feet? Did they consider each one of themselves to be too important to engage in such a menial task? However, Jesus engaged in the menial task, thus letting them know that it was not too low of a task for them to have performed. And again, they would have remembered this object lesson all the rest of the days of their lives. Notice that Jesus said this was an example, not a church ordinance. Some have made foot washing an act of worship. However, unlike the Lord's Supper, this was not an ordinance being introduced, nor was it ever practiced by the church anywhere in the New Testament. The purpose of this example is to avoid spiritual pride amongst us, and that is always a danger. But many do not understand that what Jesus was doing was exactly that, just an example. Jesus did not require this form to be repeated. He wanted the spirit of the example to be done again. We are in no wise greater than our Lord. And if we cannot humble ourselves as he did, we have missed the point of the example. But we will be happy if we follow it. And not uncoincidentally, Jesus says in Matthew 5:3, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, the humble, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." It is the humble who shall be happy. And so this coincides with what he had taught previously. There is happiness in humility. Now let's read the last three verses that we're going to consider this morning, verses 18 through 20. Jesus says, "I do not speak concerning all of you, and I know whom I have chosen, and that the scripture may be fulfilled, 'He who eats bread with me has lifted up his heel against me.' Now I tell you before it comes, that when it does come to pass, that you may believe that I am he. Most assuredly I say to you, he who receives whomever I sends receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me." We want to look at these last few comments in connection with this passage. To eat someone's bread and then do him harm indicates an evil heart that is lacking, and of course this is what Judas did, that is lacking in love, gratitude, and compassion. This should be avoided, this kind of action should be avoided at all costs. And then lifting up the heel is actually a term, a wrestling term, in which one participant tries to trip his opponent or cause him to fall. This was predicted, prophesied in the Old Testament. Let's back up to Zechariah chapter 11. Verses 12 and 13, to notice that what Judas did was foretold. Zechariah 11, beginning with verse 12, "Then I said to them, 'If it is agreeable to you, give me my wages, and if not, refrain.' So they weighed out for my wages 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said to me, 'Throw it to the potter, that princely price they set on me.' So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them into the house of the Lord for the potter." Well, this is the price Judas received, and this is what happened to the 30 pieces of silver. So this is a fulfilled prophecy precisely as given in the Old Testament. But here is a lesson. The purest institution on earth had an evil man in it. People are often surprised, but the devil spends probably most of his time working on Christians. And Judas may well have been guilty of all three of the types of sins that John records in 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through the 17, where he talks about the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Definitely, he was guilty of the lust of the eyes, covetousness. If someone today charges that churches have hypocrites in them, they may well be correct. It has been that way from the beginning. But it won't be that way in heaven. And so if you want to leave hypocrites behind, that's the place you need to be, is in heaven. Thus, you would need to be doing what God commands on earth right now, which includes meeting on the first day of the week and encouraging and exhorting one another. There may be hypocrites present. Judas was present among the 12. But that should not keep the rest from doing what ought to be done. Some bad men creep into the fold. Verse 19, Jesus again says that he is the I am. Now there is a he in the text, but you'll notice it is in italics, just as in some other places. Jesus identifies himself as the eternal God. And they needed to notice this. They needed to recall this during the time of the crucifixion. Because it is going to look like Jesus is just a man. It is going to look like the world has domination over him. It is going to look like he is defenseless. But death will not hold him. He will arise from the dead. And he will ascend into heaven. He is the I am, just as he has spoken about it in John 8 in verse 58. One last thought here is to receive the words of the messengers of the king is to receive the king himself. If a king could not generally go around and talk to each city and town, it would have taken all of his time. So he sent forth messengers. But if somebody refused to listen to the messenger, they were refusing to listen to the king himself. But to receive the words of the messenger is to receive the king. Christians are the messengers of God today. We don't have our own message. We don't have something new that cannot be found in the scriptures. This is our message. Christ is our message. Salvation is our message because it's what the king gave to his disciples to present to all. And so we are light in a world of darkness representing the king. We cannot personally worry about rejection. Because it's not Christians that are being rejected, it's the one who sent Christians who is being rejected. We ought to keep that in mind because people are not rejecting the servants of the king, they are rejecting the king. A lesson in great humility Jesus has presented by a vivid demonstration, by putting on the towel and washing the disciples' feet, how much we ought to desire to imitate him in all things and to be faithful servants, unlike Judas, fulfilling his will, shining his light in the world, taking the message of the King to those who need to obey it and likewise become servants. If we can help you in that regard this morning, we invite you to come as we're going to stand and sing. If you've already done that but have not been living faithfully, you don't want to end up where Judas is. Repent and come back to the truth that you once knew and obeyed. If we can help you with the gospel in any sense, come while we stand and while we sing.